Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to All Exits Closed. My guest today is Steve Greenfield. And Steve and I are going to have a conversation about opening up the economy. So, Steve, what are your thoughts about how things are going to reopen?
Well, we are really facing two separate narratives from our major institutions right now, and both of them are completely made up, and both of them, unsurprisingly, conform very closely to the kinds of intellectual expectations that the people that support those various established institutions tend to expect, rather than reflecting any independent science in either medicine or economics that, you know, actually pertains to the situation. We have Republicans, by and large, believing that the shutdown was a massive overreaction, unnecessary, and in some instances even a conspiracy to harm 320 million people. And that's the range of the discussion on the right among conservatives, and the range of discussion among liberals tends to be that the medical science was correct, that the political decisions made in response to it were correct, and now that the curve has been flattened, we can, you know, judiciously and scientifically ease our way back into economic function. So basically what you've got is the exact same scenario, just on two different timelines and with two different sets of vocabulary. You know, the conservatives are saying, oh, it was a big mistake and we can just go right back to what we were doing. And the liberals are saying, it wasn't a big mistake, but we can slowly go back to what we were doing. Right? So you've got basically the exact same story and two different timelines and two different kinds of presentation and vocabulary, but both are saying essentially the same thing. And as I said at the beginning, the way that the two different versions are being said only differ from each other in how they conform in vocabulary to the expectations of the target audience that they're respectively being said to. So what we really have to start talking about is about the inherent falseness. I don't want to even call them two narratives, because if it's the same narrative just played out along two different timelines, then it's a single narrative, right? So the problem with the narrative is that the shutdowns, the things that we're facing, the deaths, which are already at about 76,000 in the United States, are based on a medical situation, right? I mean, there's no denying that people are sick, that millions of us are sick, that 76,000 of us have already died, and that we can't really estimate how many of us are sick, because apparently in about half the cases, there are no symptoms whatsoever. People who are contagious to others don't even know that they're sick, you know, and have no reason to believe that they are. That's just the nature of this disease. Compared to earlier SARS, it has extremely mild symptoms. Even as deadly as it is to people with pre-existing weaknesses, it obviously has very, very mild symptoms, in many cases no symptoms at all. That's the reality of the situation that we're in. And no matter how we back ourselves out of ordinary activity and ease ourselves back into ordinary activity, or rush back into ordinary activity, or whatever it is that various people are thinking is the timeline that we're looking at, the fact of the matter is that without a cure for the disease itself, or a vaccine for the disease itself, with millions of people already carrying this virus in their own active biological hosts, right? So we know that if this disease sits on a flat surface, it dies within a day, right? Or whatever, it becomes inactive fairly soon. But that's not what viruses do, right? They don't sit on dead, flat surfaces. They're hosted in our live bodies, and they never go away. Right? They don't die in a day if they're in our bodies. They live forever if they're in our bodies. They keep reproducing. And in particular, they'll keep reproducing in the bodies of people who don't feel any symptoms because they're not causing any harm to those people. This means that this contagion is going to be available to continue being contagious until such time as it can be eradicated by some combination of treatments and vaccines. And that's not happening. And we have no way of knowing when it will happen. And, you know, most distressingly of all, we have no way of knowing if it will happen, because many viruses are not curable, and we've been pouring billions of dollars into figuring out how to cure them. You know, and many viruses do not have vaccines. And, you know, so anybody who's telling people we should have a vaccine within a year to 18 months is also comforting people with false information. There has never been a vaccine ever developed in under 4 years.
Right? Okay, let me ask you this. In the pandemic of 1918, after a couple of years, the virus just died out. There was no vaccine then. And I think the rule of thumb is now, maybe in 2 years, it will just die out. In the turn of the 20th century, it just disappeared. What makes you think, or do you think the same thing can happen now?
I think it's possible, right? I'm not denying that it can happen. What I am saying is that nobody knows if it will happen. Nobody has any information available to them right now that suggests that we can start reopening either quickly or slowly, right? No, nobody has the information. That's the point that I'm trying to make here, is that we have major institutions that manage communications on public affairs issues to two halves of our population. And both of those communication systems are completely making up the information that they're giving. And if it could take 2 years before the strain could die away, that's something obviously that we need to be admitting to ourselves, because you can put a plan in place for how to reopen, but you don't know what day you're going to be able to start implementing that plan, and you shouldn't be telling people that you do. One thing we know for sure is that it's neither now nor very soon, right? We absolutely know that, because we've currently got several million people infected that are actively infected right now, and so they're also continuing to infect other people with whom they have contact. Right. So we're nowhere near, you know, the stage of having a discussion of when we could speculate that things could start reopening. Right. We have to accept that. We have to accept that with, you know, millions of people, likely tens of millions of people actively infectious right now. If each one of those people comes in contact with, you know, 5 million people, five people, say their own families, just their own families, the people with whom they live, then that's 50 million infected people. That could, you know, we could reach that number, you know, in a couple of weeks if we change the precautions that we're using, right? Now, we could only be having the kind of discussions that the liberals and conservatives are having in their public affairs commentary if the infection rate had collapsed, and if the number of people that we know to be infected because they've been tested and we know them to be infected were rapidly falling and on an arc towards approaching zero. If we saw that that was happening, we could start having the kind of conversations that liberal and conservative communication system are having. But the opposite of that is the case. We are not, you know, watching those curves decline in any way. In some sections, they're flat. In other sections, they're still growing. Even if we wanted to look at where we are right now as a peak, well, with 76,000 people already dead, if we're at the peak, then it stands to reason that another 76,000 are going to be dead before we can get back to where we were when we started. Right? I mean, that's what the word peak means. It's not it's not like we're falling off a cliff. And we also know, looking at the data, that these peaks are not sharp peaks followed by declines, but that they're plateaus. They just continue flat for a while. So all I'm trying to explain here is that we are not yet anywhere near where we need to be with the progress of the disease across the population to even be having this kind of conversation. Okay, so that's for starters. The second thing we need to discuss is that because a lot of our restrictions, whether we ease in a return and then have to back off it again as more people get infected or whatever it is that's happening, is that the response that we've had so far has resulted in the onset of a massive economic restructuring, facilitated by tech that is not going to be reversed, you know, and I'll just identify for people a couple of the obvious things about that. Millions of people are currently still working. A lot of office workers, right? Not people who are in manufacturing. A lot of office work, which is the majority of our work, because we're something like an 85% service economy at this point. Only about less than 10% of our economy is manufacturing and agriculture in terms of the number of employees that are involved. So people are working, right? We've got 31 million people who lost their jobs, but there are still, you know, 240 million people who have not, right? So we have to think about that. And those people are working online. Those people are working at home online, and their businesses are pretty much limping along like that and staying solvent while they do that. And as that is happening, commercial real estate leases are expiring. The tech companies, you know, Zoom and all the things like that are stepping up to show people how they can have meetings and conferences without having to be in a room together. And when you're in a room together, you're paying a couple $1,000s a month in rent. You know, if you're a retail store, you might be paying $30,000 a month in rent, and the Amazon warehouse isn't paying that kind of rent, right? So if you're in retail, if you're an office worker of some kind, commercial real estate is not going to recover, right? So there's a problem right there. There's businesses are finding out exactly how much money they can save by using electronic meeting systems and letting people work at home. As commercial real estate collapses, the property taxes that it generates for public administration, for fixing the roads, for paying the police and firefighters, commercial property tax rates are much higher than residential tax rates. And that's our revenue stream for operating schools, you know, courts, roads, plowing the roads, everything about that. We do not have any system by which to tax people once they're all working at home. Do we raise residential taxes? How is that reasonable to people who aren't working at home? Who pays that? We're not having any of these discussions, even though we can already see that these permanent changes to how much of our economy. Now, if we had not converted ourselves through our international trade agreements into a country in which under 10% of the employed people of this country are still doing manufacturing and agriculture, we would still need floor space, right? A factory needs floor space. That's something there's no getting around. We would not be having this severe a problem. There are countries all around the world that are still with the bulk of their employees earning income in manufacturing positions that have tangible jobs that they have to go to. But as a service economy, we are experiencing shifts that are not going to be restored. And not because people won't want to restore them, but because in capitalism, whatever saves the most money in input costs for the people that are selling goods and services is the path that they're going to pursue. So we're going to see dramatic scaling back in commercial real estate. And along with that, because a lot of people are like, oh, what do I care about rich capitalists? Well, those rich capitalists, because of the way our property taxes are distributed, that's where our public services receive the bulk of their income, and currently there are no legislatures that are working on being ready for a ready-to-go restructuring of the tax code so that public functions can still be financed. And if public functions can't be financed, then cops are going to be fired, teachers are going to be fired, firefighters are going to be fired, the town highway people are going to be fired, you know, in order to get closer to the bone. And when those people are all fired, they're not going to be consuming, spending money. So you're talking about a continuing economic downturn, simply on the grounds that millions and millions of the 31 million who have become unemployed thus far are not going back to their jobs on any kind of knowable timetable. And by the same token, even as people do start going back to their jobs, there's going to be so much change in the way we collect our taxes and the sources of tax revenues that there will be cascading effects into new cuts in public employees while we try to figure out how to recover those revenue streams. And so, you know, again, I want to return this to my original theme, which is that the principal spokespeople of our two major parties and the institutions that consider themselves aligned with those two major parties is completely fabricated. And nobody should be trying to gauge what their own future looks like, how they want to vote, how, you know, any of this stuff based on which, you know, both sides are basically presenting their respective versions of what their audiences consider comforting information. But it's all completely made up.
Okay, let me ask you this question, Steve. You're saying that there's going to be major dislocations. People are going to lose their jobs. They're going to lose their livelihood. Where will they go?
You know, we don't have answers to that. That's part of the problem, right? I mean, one of the things that I've been telling people about for years, and I'm not alone. I want to be very careful. I don't want them to think that, like, I think of myself as a unique visionary of some kind, right? There are schools of thought about this kind of thing, and I am merely a student of those schools of thought and report this stuff out. We don't have any resilience in our particular economic system. We did not build reserves. You know, it's kind of interesting because in the book of Genesis, in the Bible that was written 3,300 years ago, one of the earliest stories of the book is about Joseph, who is carried away to Egypt and ends up locked up in prison and then rises to be the second in command of the Egyptian empire because he's brought before the Pharaoh and he advises the Pharaoh, hey, we're living in times of plenty. We're producing fantastic surpluses in this civilization, but it's a pretty safe bet that, you know, these things always turn around and then you go into a period of lean, you go into a period of shortage. And so if you want to be a really smart Pharaoh, you should build giant storehouses so that we could store the surplus grain that we're growing now in our time of plenty. And that way, all the other countries in the world will be starving if things turn around, but we'll have enough to eat, right? That was the story of Joseph, who is turned around from a captive and a prisoner into being second in command of the Egyptian empire. And of course, his wisdom in the story, as it's told, turns out to be true. There is an economic downturn. There is starvation all over, you know, the Middle East and Central Asia, and everyone who wants to survive has to move to Egypt to make sure they have enough to eat, right? So we've known this as a principle of economics. Civilization, Western civilization, has known this as a principle of economics, you know, obviously pre-capitalism, pre-feudalism, pre-everything, you know, to the dawn of civilization itself. When we first started farming, we already knew, you know, sometimes there's a drought. Sometimes the food won't grow, even if it's just a matter of the weather. And so when things are good and you're overproducing, a prudent society will save up, will create reserves. We don't do that in America. We have no reserves. We have no reserves for anything. One of the examples I like to use for people is that in Cuba, for all of its shortcomings, nobody ever dies in a hurricane. They have built giant shelters, underground bunkers. They're stocked with weeks' worth of food, non-perishable food that could, you know, last people. You know, and as a result of that, Nobody in Cuba ever dies in a hurricane. Yeah, their incomes are lower than ours. You know, a few other things, right? Their economy is not as productive as the United States' economy per hour of labor put in. But then again, nobody down there ever dies in a hurricane. They're fully prepared. When the weather forecast comes in, they go into their shelters and they stay there until the hurricane is gone. And then even while they're rebuilding, they had food stockpiled in the shelters. And so nobody goes hungry and they have enough to eat while they go about rebuilding from the hurricane. Okay, the exact opposite happens every time there's a hurricane in the United States. You know, we have no preparation. We have nothing stored up. We have no shelters for anybody to go to, even though we know that there's going to be 10 or 11 hurricanes every single season. Right? Mm-hmm. That's a known. So how do we explain that we, unique among the nations of the world, what we call ourselves by this word, American exceptionalism, how could it be that we have the world's the largest economy in the history of the world, a $20 trillion economy, and we don't put, I don't know, say half a trillion a year and leave ourselves 19.5 trillion is still a tremendous amount of money to divide up amongst 320 million people. So how could it be that we have never had an ongoing policy of just holding aside as reserves, the same way banks are supposed to hold, you know, 10% reserves in case people want to make withdrawals more on one particular day than they do, you know, on a typical day so that the banks don't collapse. How is it that we haven't been setting aside $500 billion a year in building resiliency into our systems so that when we have economic downturns, so that when we have a pandemic disease, so that if there's a war, you know, anything, you know, and it's not like, gee, who could have thought of that happening, right? These are things that always happen, you know, and everyone knows that they're going to happen. So why do we operate our economy and our government in such a way that we're not holding a little bit of the surpluses on the side in storable fashions, you know, money, food, shelter, everything about that, you know, as a hedge, right? Hedge funds have a hedge. People that invest in stocks always put a certain amount of their money in bonds, which are safe. In case the stocks go down, they haven't lost all their money, right? Capitalism understands the concept of security, of a hedge. That's even the word that stockbrokers use, hedge. Hedge against downturn, hedge against disaster. We don't do that as a country.
Okay, let me ask you this question. You're running for Congress. You're running for Congress as a Green against Antonio Delgado, who's an incumbent Democrat. On the campaign trail, even though it's viral now, when you bring up that issue, when you bring up the issue of, you know, preparing for the future, what do people tell you?
Interestingly enough, they all recognize the issue. Okay, everyone recognizes the issue, but then everybody promptly falls back behind their tribal barricades. The general message that I keep hearing from people is, you're right, but we have to get back to that after we solve our immediate problem of getting rid of the Republicans. As if getting rid of the Republicans is the problem that we're having, as opposed to just a problem that we're having. And completely failing to recognize that if anything that somebody does in the course of running in an election causes them to win that election, they're not going to change that thing 2 years from now. Like this idea that it's a bridge that will pressure them to start doing things differently once they're elected, that's not going to happen, because whatever it is that got them elected is what they're going to do again next time. And they're still going to be running against a Republican next time. And you're still going to feel like, okay, it didn't work, but we still have to stick with them because the only alternative is to elect a Republican, and that would be even worse. So people are trapped inside this cycle of learned helplessness that we've had, and it is the learned helplessness that is allowing this kind of thing to continue. I have generally not been speaking to my own campaign when we do these podcasts but I am going to do so now. And I really hope that at some point Antonio Delgado does respond in kind and comes to speak to some of these issues and respond to them, because this is really, really critical. There are 435 people in the House of Representatives, and there are another 100 people in the Senate. Everybody in this country has 535 federal legislative representatives all together, and none of them are talking about this, let alone engaging in any planning to do something about it. I want to send a message to the people of the 19th District, and I want to actually send this message to everybody, because you don't have to live in the 19th District to donate to a campaign and make it possible for a new message to actually enter the legislative arena. If I get elected to Congress this November, all that will actually happen is that there will still be 534 Democrats and Republicans. It's not like I will be able to force any of them to accept my platform and my policy submissions and anything else. If you're worried about what could happen is only that the discussion enters the floor of Congress, that it will be in the media, it'll be on C-SPAN, it'll be on TV shows, it'll be spoken on the floor of Congress, so that the people in the two major parties will be forced by just one voice, by one voice on the floor, they will be forced to answer to why they're not telling the truth, to why they're not engaging in the proper planning for how our economy is going to gradually transition, to acknowledging that things are going to be different, to start developing new forms of revenue generation for public services so that public services don't collapse and so that we don't fall into complete chaos the way the Soviet Union did in 1991, because that's what we're talking about here. If we are not planning now, looking at the facts on the ground about what's happening medically, about what's happening economically, and about what things are going never to go back to the way that they were, if we're not working on that now so that when we need those revenues, we're able to generate them, then we are planning to go through what the Soviet Union went through in 1991. And we are going to go through it for the exact same reason that they went through it, because we've been in Afghanistan since 2001, which is the exact same place where they were doing the exact same thing they were doing, right? Fighting, they believed, Muslim extremists so that a civil government could be formed in Afghanistan. And they bankrupted themselves, and they left themselves without the resources they needed at home to correct their collapsing economy, because everything they had was in their war machine. And we have everything we have in our war machine. And nobody, no Democrat, no Republican, there's nobody out there right now going on the floor of Congress and saying, why can't we get all these people and all this machinery back home? This is a crisis. This is a potentially existential crisis. And we're still nation building in other places. Iraq and Afghanistan were not failed states until we invaded them. Okay, they're not going to be able to solve their coronavirus problems, because they're now failed, collapsed, chaotic states like Somalia. And they had Libya too, right? These are countries that had centralized, directed governments. Their dictatorial nature or whatever else is involved notwithstanding, at least they had functioning civilizations that could be responsive to the maintenance of their own civilization. We have caused failed states around the world through our military action. We have no way of restoring them. We certainly don't have the resources right now to restore them when we don't even know what's happening here at home. No Democrat, no Republican is talking about war and ending it. We've been there since we're almost up to 19 full years that these multiple wars have been operating. Our military budgets keep escalating. Our medical budgets keep declining. everything that could be done wrong is being done wrong in equal measure by both parties, right? The worst coronavirus response in this entire country has been here in New York. We're leading the country in everything, infections, deaths, spread rate, everything that could possibly be measured. New York State is, and yet there are Democrats that, millions of Democrats who insist that this whole thing is Trump's fault and that we should have Andrew Cuomo be president. And and my head spins when I hear that. I say, how could you be recommending, of all the Democrats in America, how could you be recommending the one responsible for the worst coronavirus response in the whole country to be the one that replaces Trump? Like, why aren't you mentioning Jay Inslee, at least, over in Washington, who did a pretty good response pretty early on? Why are you touting the one Democrat whose response is the worst in the country? And so
our time is up.
We're
today.
Out of time.
So we will continue this conversation. So in like a minute, can you give your platform for candidacy?
We're talking about improved public health, economic resiliency, Green New Deal, slashing the military, ending non-defensive war. Everyone, please go to stevegreenfieldforcongress.com. Pretty easy to remember my name, stevegreenfieldforcongress.com. Or write to me, email, greenfieldforcongress@gmail.com. I will respond to you myself. I need donations. Campaigning is going to have to be done online this year rather than face-to-face, and that's going to take a little bit more money than we usually use, and it also opens up the possibility that this campaign can win, because the large ground games of the Democratic Party and Republican parties will not be able to be used this year. We're all going to be operating online and in media commercials and things like that. So please come to my page, stevegreenfieldforcongress.com. Send me a message. Give me a small donation. It'll be the best political activity you've supported in your life.
And I invite Antonio Delgado to come on All I Disclose to talk about the stuff we've been discussing today. So you've been listening to Steve Greenfield. This is All I Disclose. I'm Cynthia Pooler, and if you like this show, like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Steve, have a great day, and thank you, everybody, for listening.
You too. Thank you.